PI for the financial assistance and so on and so forth. So I'm a master student of Sean, and Sean's at Nijmegen in Holland, and Gerard de Tof at the University of Utrecht. Now I convinced Gerard de Tof to take me on and do a master's thesis in shape dynamics, because he was interested in theories with conformal symmetry. Little did he know at the time, it was actually three-dimensional conformal symmetry that I was interested in, whereas he's interested in the four-dimensional conformally invariant theory, but he went along with it anyway.
Have you convinced him?
I haven't convinced him, but yeah, work in progress. So my thesis was basically to look at some concrete situations in GR, which are well known in shape dynamics, and then compare their predictions. So in this talk, you're going to see a lot more general relativity than you'd expect for a shape dynamics talk. So Julian's probably going to be unhappy, but it's good to know your enemy, basically. So let's begin. I noticed there are lots of people that aren't very familiar with shape dynamics, and thanks, Henry. That's not distracting at all. Thank you, Sean. My supervisor to the rescue.
We do this to everybody.
Fine. But I realize there's not a lot of, some people don't know a lot about shape dynamics and probably haven't done a lot of the Hamiltonian formalism of GR. So I'll go over that quickly because most people know it, but I think it's important. And then I'll consider the spherically symmetric time-dependent vacuum solution to Einstein's equations with the shape dynamics point of view. And then a quick recap of the thin shell collapse in GR and how it relates to Andreas's solution earlier, and in particular his underdeterminism that he found. So let's start. Okay, so general relativity in the ADM Hamiltonian formalism, first given by Arnowitz, Deyser, and Meissner, Deyser. So it splits the four-dimensional space-time into these three-dimensional space-like surfaces, and it makes a decomposition of the metric tensor into these variables here. This we call the lapse, the shift, the psi, and the 3x3 matrix, which is the three-dimensional metric, space-like metric. So these are these leaves, people call them the foliation. And you have the canonical relations between the metric and its momentum. The four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance comes back, is given here in terms of you can choose any coordinates on each slice, and you can slice space-time up in any way you like. And to get back your four-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. Then you take Einstein's equations, which are kind of neatly packaged in his field equations in the vacuum. And when you make this decomposition, you end up with these constraints. This one we call the scalar constraint or the Hamiltonian constraint, and this one the diffeomorphism or the vector constraint. this is what they look like explicitly in terms of the metric variables and their momenta. It's the three-dimensional Ricci scalar on each space-like surface. The vector constraint, which you've seen in Flavio's talk and Andreas, and the kind of dynamical Hamilton's equations for G and P. I haven't written them out here because they're a bit long and I didn't have room on the slides. So we've had motivation from Flavio, but I give it again here. A lot of it comes from the initial value problem from James York in the 70s, that he highlighted that the unconstrained data that you need to give on a space like hypersurface to uniquely predict the evolution is actually the conformal free geometry. And this is, we take this result very seriously, and it forms part of the motivation of shape dynamics. You can show, and Neil showed, that the scalar constraint, which this one here, once you decompose it in terms of the, you could call them shape variables, you know everything in this scalar constraint except for the conformal factor. So you can treat this as an equation that determines the local scale. So we treat this equation from from Einstein's field equations differently because we treat local scale differently. So where does shape dynamics live? Well, it's conformal superspace. What is that? Well, you start off with Riemann, which is the space of all three-dimensional metrics, smooth and whatever. You can quotient this space, which basically gets rid of all the coordinate data, because three geometries can be represented by many different three metrics, as we know. And you can quotient further by taking out the scale of these free geometries, and that leads you to a conformal superspace. So that's all conformal geometries, three geometries. This is a nice picture that I've taken from Flavio's tutorial, which is brilliant. You should check it out. Just buy the book. Sorry, buy the book. Yeah.
But it's not available. The unavailable book. Buy the unavailable book.
But the meaning of this picture is the kind of to show the two ways of describing gravitational physics. You have the space-time picture, and these are these different foliations here, the blue curve, the dotted curve, and the red dotted curve. Lead to two different curves in superspace. And of course, there are infinitely many ways you can slice this space-time, and you end up with infinitely many curves here. And this is not the kind of Hamiltonian ideal we would like. We would like to have, as Julian pointed out earlier, a point and a tangent vector, or a point and a direction in conformal superspace. Yes, he'll drum that into you, and to uniquely predict a curve in this space that you've chosen. Okay, you've seen this again, so repeating a lot of material here, but the relation between ADM, general relativity, and shape dynamics is kind of nicely summarized in this picture here, where on this conformal surface we have shape dynamics where it lives. It has the three-dimensional conformal invariance. And on this kind of vertical surface here we have the Hamiltonian evolution of GR, and these two surfaces intersect each other. And this is where we postulate that the physics takes place. All right, so the first situation I looked at is the simplest you could envisage, is the spherically symmetric time-dependent vacuum solution. I'll race through this because you'll know the answer already. So in shape dynamics, we want to make another decomposition of the variables. We had the ADM decomposition, we further decompose this because we want to separate the scale, the local scale, which resides in this omega, the conformal factor. It's a canonically conjugate variable, the trace of the momentum. And these one could call the shape degrees of freedom. The
what is gamma?
Sorry?
Gamma
is like a reference metric. It doesn't really, it sits there all the time, so that this is really a scalar and you're not taking the logarithm of a, I mean, but it's not very important. So these are where the shape degrees of freedom reside, this G tilde and P tilde. And as Flavio succinctly put it in the introduction, in the spherically symmetric case is very boring from this point of view, because you can make a choice of a radial gauge, basically. You choose your isotropic radial coordinate such that your three metric is conformally flat. And this means that the shape degrees of freedom are fixed completely to be this constant, the flat metric. And the shape momenta vanishes. So you're left with a point in conformal superspace.
You don't have to pick that particular coordinate system for the diagonal metric.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, because, I mean, the theorem works both ways. If you can find a coordinate system where it's conformally flat, then the coordinate tensor must vanish, right?
No.
Sorry?
If it is conformally flat, the coordinate tensor vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did I say?
If you can find a coordinate system...
I said, if you can find a coordinate system where the three metric is conformally flat, then the coordinate tensor must vanish.
That's right. It's
different only here, so it works both ways. Right? So this is why I sent you the email now. And we know that it must be true because you can find this coordinate system. So the other part of the story in shape dynamics is that it has this fixed foliation, and in GR it's called the maximal slicing. And it's that the trace of the momenta vanishes, and you have this condition on the lapse here.
Maybe here you want to remark that you're already assuming asymptotic flatness, I guess, the look of that metric.
You're not assuming asymptotic
flatness. Well, the metric.
You're assuming maybe open spatial topology, but.
I don't know. Not even that, because you can.
This is not the three metric, though, right? This is the... You have a conformal factor sitting in front of this.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
The reference metric.
Right. So am I assuming asymptotic conditions here or not?
You're not assuming anything, because this is...
Not for genome, it's not.
You're assuming in vacuum and maximum slicing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the lapse.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't think I was assuming asymptotic flatness here. I thought that came out of the derivation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the compact case is obtained by replacing R's with sines, sine of some angle. But it's not a coordinate choice, really. The fact is that you can map a compact reference metric to a non-compact. G and vice versa. So here it's choosing a non compact reference metric. That's all.
But you still then have your conformal factor as diseases.
Either it goes to zero or it goes to infinity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But you want to go from one to two.
Yeah. Okay.
If you think that's bad,
but I don't.
All right. Thanks. This was originally Enrique's solution, where we thought somehow this was the only possible solution in shape dynamics. But Sean and I have shown that this is a particular case, and we know it corresponds to the static solution. and the static solution is the isotropic line element given here. It has this relationship with the Schwarzschild radius, and it has this mirror inversion symmetry, which we saw with the Mona Lisa earlier.
But just to be clear, in the original derivation, I did not impose that G dot would be zero, right?
You assume this, you get this.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
At infinity. That's what I assumed, that Xi falls off as 1 over R or something.
Fine, but
it's a constant.
Yeah. Okay.
But that determines The shift, that's the shift.
But what I want to say is that you don't have to assume this thing is zero, the shift, and that's the next slide. And this is just the space-time picture of what these slices look like. Andreas has showed you this already. This is the three-dimensional picture. It's the wormhole, or the bridge, or it's two exterior sphere shield wedges here, glued together. Sure.
Yeah, like the
emergency. I said it, but I said it really fast. And so we have the laps here, the conformal factor, and then the flat reference metric here. It's related to the Schwarzschild metric by this transformation, and this transformation is 2:1. So for every R, there are two R's. Big R, there are two little R's. Sorry. And it has this inversion symmetry about the horizon, which is in these coordinates, little R is at M over 2.
So if you redefine R by R bar, you get an
idea. Yeah, if you put this R into here, in terms of R bar, you get the line element back. So that's the mirror inversion.
And also, like this one, the horizons at r equals m over 2.
M over 2.
This nice thing about this thing is worth pointing out is that it actually, the metric itself is smooth through the horizon, and then is defined over the whole.
Which metric? Space-time.
This line element or the spatial metric.
Spatial metric.
The spatial. Yeah.
But the space-time metric is.
Oh, that, no.
It's a zero, but it's still smooth.
No. Yeah. No. What do you mean by
it was
that?
Smooth. I don't think.
Well,
you
the
mean
coordinate system just doesn't go.
No, it's not. So here, if you just keep here, and if you take little r to m over 2, mm-hmm. right, the lapse goes to 0. Mm-hmm. But not only that, it's different than just the lapse going to 0. If you look at the determinant, if you assume this is really valid for all r's, mm-hmm. right, and you look at the determinant of this metric, mm-hmm. which is a diffeomorphism invariant. You see that it goes to 0
because of this factor here.
So that's right. So the four metric actually becomes degenerate there. Mm-hmm.
But it's degenerate, but it's continuous. I think that there's a delta function singularity in the curvature scalar.
In the curvature.
At the horizon.
Four-dimensional
curvature.
That's true.
Which is the problem. I mean, since we're talking about this.
So not smooth, continuous, but not smooth.
Yeah, this is a good point, because this is why it's not considered a vacuum solution in general relativity.
Right.
So
but from the point of view of shape dynamics, there's no problem.
So actually, can I say a bit more, because it's worth it? Like, not only is there a curvature singularity, the Einstein tensor has a delta function at the horizon, which means that if you were interpreting this in the space-time picture, then it means that the energy momentum tensor that sources it has to also be divergent. And so, you might regard that as a bad thing, right? And I mean, it's funny though, because if you read Einstein, so this is a paper by Einstein and Rosen, right? This is the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So Einstein just said, oh, why don't we just modify the field equations by multiplying by g squared, determine g squared, and then there's no problem. So he's a pretty bold guy, right? Nobody would do that anymore. But
it was his equation, so.
But that was highlighting the fact that the problem is in the determinant of the space-time metric, right? In particular the lapse vanishing. So I think that's why in shape dynamics this comes out as our solution, because the thing that's problematic in the space-time picture is not problematic in shape dynamics. Mm. So,
hopefully?
Well, it doesn't seem to be, right? I mean,
let's update that. We had this discussion like yesterday, Michon, and the thing is, what you want to check is whether there are tidal forces that are this the divergent when you get close to the horizon. That's the thing.
Yes.
The 56 appear to be fine. They're not time like that.
Good point.
They're time like. But yeah, you want really to send a baseball for the thing and see what happens. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Good. Mm-hmm. All right. I think we'll understand the space-time picture now. So what we'd like to, I mean, it looks very disjoint, this, I mean, in GI it looks trivial. We've just chosen coordinates that covered the exterior region. But we're hoping in shape dynamics that we can somehow understand this space-time as a understand the shape dynamic solution as a physical solution, even though it looks very disjoint in the space-time picture. So I mentioned that there are other solutions that, yes, go ahead.
This is identical to the Schwarzschild line element in isotropic coordinates.
Correct.
So,
but it stops at r equals n over 2.
But that's just because these coordinates do not cover, they're not good to cover through.
Correct.
So where's the delta function? That's
yeah.
Where's the delta function in the f? I mean,
it's like
that's not sufficient to see that.
If you just take this, no, that's true. If you take the line element as like, you should forget about Schwarzschild and Max Nix and Pascal. And you say, yeah, this is my measure. Calculate the curvature components.
Yeah, I think the thing is that
you have to use R goes from 0 to the other.
Yeah, if you glue the two regions, then at the interface, you will get a delta distribution the momentum tensor.
Right.
The Einstein tensor will be equal to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Can I jump in there? Because if we're looking to kind of discard this, all right, we want to discard this interior region and somehow glue these exterior wedges onto each other. That, by the Israel conditions, is going to require some energy momentum, and this is the energy momentum delta function. Awesome.
Yeah, it's to suppress his
uncomfortable
wish. And now it's working. Okay. Okay. Right. So that's where this delta function is going to come in. But there are other slices that are non-static, and Andreas also showed these. And Niall also made the correct statement that there are also these slices that you say start from the singularity here and come backwards to this point 3m over 2.
So they just cover that region from r equals 0 to r equals 3m over 2.
So there are these ones which go from infinity to infinity, and there are ones which go from the singularity to the singularity, and one covers from 2m to 3m over 2, and one goes from 0 to 3m over 2. They don't cross.
Right.
So is it exactly 0?
What do you mean exactly 0?
Well,
yeah, they do. They intersect this.
Zero. They intersect the singularity,
yeah,
right? They run from, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
From layer to layer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And they go right into the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
They go into the singularity.
They go into the singularity. They go into the singularity.
So, especially they are compact.
They're compact, mm-hmm. Yeah. But the singular both ends are stupid. You don't want to talk about. But nevertheless, you get two families.
Right.
Four families.
So on comparing kind of the GR interpretation and the shape dynamics interpretation, in GR these different slices are clearly a different congruence of observers that are moving at they're boosted and accelerated somehow to these Eulerian observers of the static slicing. This difference goes to zero to infinity, but here, I mean, it's very different. These penetrate the horizon, these slices. But how do we interpret these different congruence? I mean, a congruence of observers in a space-time is not kind of part of the description that we want to appeal to in shape dynamics. So I think that's something we need to...
Yeah, so a guide could be the fact that the time variable in this slicing is precisely coincides with a integration constant that we're going to get outside of the shell.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, A would have to be monotonic, you know, that this would be good.
Mm-hmm.
And we not getting that in some cases, simple cases. So I don't know, A would be related to the momentum of the rest of the universe, the radial momentum of the rest of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that should be monotonic in order for this to make sense. And maybe not. Maybe we need to think harder.
Okay, thanks.
Another thing that comes to is comparing the GR picture with the space time is that the shape dynamics in the GR picture, you just have these maximal slices. Then in the, like, sort of that's what you were saying, like, I think the, what if you want to embrace the space shape dynamics ontology, right? You just think of this line element as the thing, and then you let R go from zero to infinity. But what does that mean in terms of the space-time? It means that you're actually identifying the region on the horizon in region one to points on the white hole horizon in region three.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like you're going, and then you're jumping from region one to region three and coming out on the other side. That's what it looks like. So it looks very weird. And that's why you need the delta function, because there's something very discontinuous happening. In these solutions, you could do. It seems like you can do the same type of thing. That's how I would interpret these solutions too. You have the slices that go above in the top half of the plane, the slices that go below, and then when you reach the horizon here, then presumably the shape dynamics interpretation is you kind of jump
at the horizon or at R equals three m ops.
No,
only
wherever the horizon is in the non-stationary maximal slices.
It means the point where the lapse vanishes is what it means.
But the lapse in this foliation doesn't vanish there.
Vanishes here,
the,
r equals 3
red,
by the 2.
On the red line?
No.
No, yeah, r equals 3 and lapse. Yeah, so not at the other horizon.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Just confusing words.
Yeah, so maybe it's not clear that, it is probably the same foliation propagates backwards in time.
So
he's saying that you have this hyperbola downstairs and an hyperbola upstairs that are equal to 3m ups, and he wants to identify them somehow, rule them, maybe even think about inverting it to probably. And Neil is really not happy with that.
No, but it looks really awkward in space-time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But when you just pop out the solution, which you guys, the most general solution in shape dynamics,
mm-hmm.
That's what you get something that looks smooth, but if you're in the space time picture, you're forced to think of it in this really weird, discontinuous way. But in shape dynamics,
but this is not. So what do you mean weird, discontinuous? This is nice. I think that this is just somehow ordinary. You know, it just goes from a slice which starts admittedly at which comes into our 3m over 2 in the bottom, and then continues to the middle, and then goes off to the future, but there is no discontinuity, and the slices don't cross, nothing happens. Nothing bad happens to any of the slices.
Right. So I guess what I was saying was that it's only in the space-time picture that things look ugly. In the shape that I'm
I think in the space-time picture they look lovely. I don't see why anybody thinks of that as ugly. What's ugly about that? it's nice.
The story of what happened. So if you're
let's move on.
GR would be an observer in his own proper time who would hit that R equals 3m ups surface.
Yeah.
And then reappear at the bottom in the
way. Maybe not
around. Well, like he continue on.
That surface also coincides with the universal horizon. R equals 1.5n.
What's the
universal horizon shows up in the scalar tensor theories of gravity, where you can have superluminal propagational fields, and that is the surface in which, with infinite speed, you still cannot escape.
Is that R equals 3m halves in Schwarzschild form and stuff?
It is.
Well,
These are aggregated.
So yes, so that's it.
Yeah. Is it maximally sliced?
No.
Or two?
So yes. Yeah,
so even if you have the infinite speed, you cannot escape.
You cannot escape. When once you cross that surface, you can escape. Even.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
it's
not
bad.
Thank you.
This is why we're having
a look. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Okay, I'm going to move on from these eternal solutions now to the thin shell collapse. And I'm just going to give a recap of what Israel did and what we know in GR and how it relates to Andreas and Flavio and Onliki's work in shape dynamics and the study of the twin shell. You start off with junction conditions, which basically ensure that the solution to Einstein's equations would be well defined as a distribution.
Sorry, what is HIJ here?
So, let me get to it. you start with a space-time, and the space-time is divided into two by this history of the thin shell, and it's a Lorentzian surface. It's two spatial one time, and this is what the HIJ is referring to. So this surface is a time-like surface, which is the history of the shell. And the first condition is just ensuring that the geometry of this time-like history is well defined. As you approach it from either side, you get the same geometry. And the other condition is.
These are orthogonal to the HIJ. What I mean is the HIJ is not the spatial.
No, it's the time-like surface. So it's one time.
Pullback of the metric on the surface of the word sheet. Of the
correct. And the other conditions are conditions on the extrinsic curvature of this time-like surface. And this is the energy momentum of the shell. This is
so these have time components, that's what I mean.
Correct.
So if you did some ADM decomposition, this particular combination would be the momentum
They would have components, that's what I mean.
Isn't it HIJ trace of K minus KJ? If you did the ADM decomposition on this surface.
Oh, on this surface, adapted to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, then.
Right?
Okay. So. Yeah.
There's not a tool.
But this is not the. It wouldn't be the usual ADM decomposition with a
time-like surface.
Yeah, with space-like surfaces.
Yeah. Okay. And you ask continuity of S.
Continuity of S.
You're just defining S here, right?
I mean, in this step. To get to this stage, I haven't required continuity of S. You've required the Einstein field equations are well defined as a distribution solution.
But I think in the end, you do define that S, that the continuity of S is actually the source of the Einstein, of the shell. The matter source of the shell is
it should be
the coincidence. Yeah, it's SIJ, actually. And that's, okay, go ahead, sorry.
Then we impose spherical symmetry, which means we want to use a form metric of this form. Imposing the first junction condition here tells you that the radial coordinate you have to use on either side of the shell should be the same, also the polar coordinates, but the time you don't require to be the same. You choose the Fs basically on what situation you want to consider. If you're considering just a shell in vacuum, then the F minus is going to be 1 because you've got no mass inside your shell. And in spatial coordinates, this F is going to be your usual 1 minus 2m over r. imposing the first junction condition, you also get this relation between the exterior time, which is t plus, and interior time t minus, and the proper time of co-movers moving along with the shell.
Can I say something though?
You go ahead.
So this is something that we discussed a little bit. These junction conditions, since they involve time, mm-hmm. they involve a space-time picture. Mm-hmm. They're not the junction conditions that are that we try to apply, for instance, in crochet dynamics. They're different. They also
right, but some of them will naturally be related to each other.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I would like to see which
Yeah, that would be a nice comparison.
If you require a continuity of the metric and a jump in the extrinsic curvature, which is what these are, then it will be the same thing.
Mm.
So are you requiring continuity of the metric across the junction and a jump in the extrinsic curvature?
That's exactly the right question.
So if you project these down, maybe they should be the same. I can imagine something new.
The thing we were discussing was the lapse, right?
That's right.
What you're imposing with the lattice.
But here, you see, since here this Hij, for example, it will contain time components, it will contain the lapse, right? And so this is requiring certain conditions in the lapse and in derivatives of the lapse, which are in Hij.
Yes, so these are sort of the time evolution. So if you just fix on a slice, you evolve the slice, and you will evolve to these conditions.
Exactly. So what I mean is that they require certain continuity conditions on these components that we are not inputting in from the start in SD, because we're at least in the conditions that we write for the labs and other things, we require continuity but not smoothness.
Because there is no way you can impose any restrictions on these things, because of course, say we have a thin shell which is solid steel and sits there, versus a thin shell, which is a bunch of dust, which doesn't sit there. And so, and the distinction between the two is moderated by the stresses in it.
The state equation.
And so until and unless you specify a specific kind of shell, you just will not be able to solve the system. So one shell will collapse in, and one shell will just sit there.
So from this, I've called this thing epsilon or E because it could be understood as, if you imagine the shell as a shell of particles, this could be understood as the energy per unit mass of a particle in the shell.
Mm-hmm.
And this relation, basically, if you know R and how it depends on tau, then you can integrate it to find your exterior time.
So here you already inputted the state equation, I guess. It's dust.
No.
Not yet.
Yeah,
no.
But it's a problem. What happens if it's moving versus it's stopped? Surely that appears somewhere.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I'll show you. Yeah, next slide. Two slides. Hang on. In the case of spherical symmetry, this Israel, the junction condition reduces to just one equation, which is, if you input epsilon here, it's an equation for R as a function of the proper time, tau. This is, the bottom equation is the conservation equation, and it tells you that if you're dealing with dust, the pressure, this is P, the pressure is zero, and your proper mass of the shell, capital M, is a constant. It's an integration of motion, constant of motion. So we consider this case, which Israel solved. You can substitute epsilon in here, and you can square the equation, and you get a nice formula expresses the conservation of energy, and it has this kind of decomposition into inertial mass energy terms and gravitational potential energy terms. This is a bit surprising in terms of the equivalence principle, but you can show that it's not a kind of fundamental split of these energy terms. Does that make sense? What I mean is, there seems to be this kind of clear splitting here of inertial mass energy and gravitational energy, and that's surprising from the point of view of the equivalence principle. But you can show that this is it's not a fundamental split. This. Anyway.
Is it just a collection of geodesic motion of massive particles? So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's the fact that there's more than one, it makes it look like. And you're using this non-fundamental quantity, like that large M, mm-hmm. the overall mass of the whole bunch of particles.
Exactly, so yeah. It's
just
the
equivalence. Mm-hmm.
That's true, that's exactly right, yeah. So you can. Take the ratio of this these two mass parameters in your problem to get this dimensionless constant, and you can plot basically three qualitatively different scenarios. When the ratio is less than one, you find that the shell only can't escape its own gravitational attraction, so it stops and comes back. The kind of point. Well, yeah, okay, you can see that it's turning over here, it's flat. No? Just me.
We trust.
And this is the case where it still has a finite velocity at infinity, and this is the case where it stops just at infinity, so it's the point where the two solutions meet. So this is the standard picture in GR that as a function of the proper time of the shell, it collapses to zero radius. But using this equation here, we can get a function of the radius as a function of the exterior time. And this is what we saw in Andreas's slide, that observers at infinity see the shell stop. The horizon. So I wanted to obtain a phase-based plot of this evolution of the shell, and this is actually relates to a conversation I had with Lee yesterday. That when you have spherical symmetry, you reduce the 3+1 problem to a 1+1 problem. And you can toy with this idea, and you can find an effective Lagrangian and an effective Hamiltonian that describes the same dynamics. And this is essentially what I've done here. You can find the momentum of the shell once you've chosen a time, and the proper time is not appropriate. So you can choose the exterior time, or you can choose the interior time, or you can choose some average of the two, which I've done here. So this allows you to define a momentum, which is this, and rearranging this equation here for the velocity, you get this. And I've made a nice phase-based plot here. The things to note are that this is actually the value of the horizon here. Got all the cases for A less than 1, greater than 1, and equal to 1. And you see that although the proper velocity is finite at the horizon, as you can see from these graphs, the momentum diverges because of this factor F that goes to 0 at the horizon.
This is just like what Andrea was showing, the horizon. But he was showing it with A, which is not exactly P.
But it's related. Right?
So it's related to R, that's the thing. So
A is related to P.
Well, in that calculation, you use isotropic coordinates, and you get that A is R times P over 2 minus. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so when R goes to the horizon, A diverges.
Mm-hmm.
When R diverges,
mm-hmm.
A diverges too,
mm-hmm. But the velocity is zero.
The velocity is zero, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what P does.
Okay.
Yeah, I want you to
check. But yeah,
so
it's what we see here. I mean, the velocity in terms of the exterior
time
is,
also,
is zero, but the momentum diverges because of this factor. Yeah.
No, I was curious about the large R when the shell escapes. Here, the momentum looks like the momentum is going to zero or a constant. I guess it will go to a constant, right? Makes sense.
Yes.
You reach an asymptotic constant momentum.
Yeah.
Right. But RA was diverging there, but A is not P.
Right, that's
R,
the difference.
So I think
okay.
Because of R,
probably, yeah.
Okay.
So, just to summarize this, we've cleared up Onoriki's solution of the spherically symmetric time-dependent vacuum solution. We've got a recap of the thin shell dynamics and the solution of the dust shell and how it relates to Andreas's solution. And at the end, we've given a nice phase-based plot of the using the kind of effective Hamiltonian and momentum that you can derive because with spherical symmetry, you're in a 1+1 situation. Thank you.
Can we have some 5 minutes for questions? That doesn't work here. Okay. Too much, huh?
Questions, comments, thoughts?
Good, everybody understood
everything. Let's get on.
The first parameter that you showed that is different from the like big M and small m. So small m, as I understand, is the mass parameter of a metric. And the big M would relate to the Brown-Yorke mass, actually.
I know it's the proper mass of the shell, so it's the integral of the proper density over the area of the shell.
It looks an awful lot like the Brown-Yorke mass because the second term has the right format, at least it would have in structure metric, as the energy cost of building the shell and bringing it.
That's right.
To the spherical condition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
Sorry, bringing it to where?
Bringing it to wherever the radius.
That's kind of the intuitive picture of Brown-Yorke.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but at infinity, yeah. Okay.
It's got to be really a mass, but
yes.
In between, the question is whether it increases or decreases or whatever happens as you come in, and Brown-Yorke increases. But only from
because of a redshift, or what was?
Should we discuss what the physical picture is of what's happening? I mean, now that we've seen both this talk and then Andreas, I guess it's the reflection symmetry that we need to understand what's happening.
Which reflection symmetry?
About the horizon.
About the horizon. The topic of Gabe's talk, I guess.
I mean, what is the picture? I mean, so maybe other. So my.
What's your version?
My version of the picture is this, okay? Maybe you guys could tell me, because actually I didn't even see the work on the picture. This is all new to me. But if you have the shell, right, starts at something, it starts to fall, and eventually it falls through its horizon. Now, first of all, do we have evidence that it falls through its own horizon? Some shells will do that. Okay. But suppose it does. Once it gets through, a new pocket of spaces now born, which is the space between, which didn't exist before, which is like a growing spatial region between the location of the shell and the original horizon. So if you were a particle, a geodesic, and you fell through that horizon, what you would see, if you use this 1/r symmetry, is that instead of the shell getting smaller, the shell is growing out to infinity. And so, but it's not at infinity, it's going there. Where are you going?
To the north.
Okay, and then so the idea would be that You go through the horizon, you come out of a white hole, and you see this shell at infinity sort of expanding out further and further. Now you can wander around this new space.
Oh, we are, but I asked
you to draw something. I wanted to draw a pair of
Can you draw something else before so people
yes.
know what...
So,
the visual... Oh, man, I was expecting a better drawing.
Yeah.
Is anyone else?
Man,
is that because I'm not...
Yeah, he's fine. No.
What I said was that crazy, right?
The picture that we would like is, you know, usually you would have this and you would have something going here, the singularity. The picture is that this is not the isotropic line element because it's always kept off by something that is like Schwarzschild inside. There's a shell here that kept it off and then it would grow off. But it's this whole thing does not exist, right? Because it's kept off by this shell here. And so inside the shell, you have this expanding Minkowski space, right? But the isotropic line element is kept off by this spherical shell. It's kind of fun. It's difficult to think about what is happening.
What do you mean by expanding Minkowski space?
Well, expanding
space.
Flat space.
FRW?
Yes.
With what source? Like, what source is the expansion? Is it vacuum?
No. It's just the fact that you see more or less. It's like either standard, regular, ordinary coordinates, and somehow if something is falling in, then there's.
It's this. I'm capping off this Minkowski space here with a ball.
Yes.
And this ball is expanding.
Ah, okay. So it's not that space is expanding, it's just the boundary that is expanding.
That's right.
Right.
The
yes.
boundary.
Well, yeah. Well, really. The conformal factor is constant. And by continuity, it has to have the same value as the conformal factor at the shell. And that is the one that's growing
okay,
for the whole thing. But it is no problem.
Yeah. But isn't that a much nicer picture than what happens in GR? I mean, I don't know.
That's not
a But like, because in GR, you go through the horizon, the signature changes, and now you're like time-like kinematic field of space line. Then you're stuck to go and hit the singularity, right?
Sorry, the symmetric. Yeah.
I mean, that is the picture that most people will see, would say is the accepted picture of what's going on, right? But I think, I mean, just from my point of view, this one actually seems a lot nicer physically, right?
I don't know.
Or
nicer
with a person falling in?
Yeah, it's much nicer with a person falling in.
Yeah.
It's much nicer for a lot of other reasons. But like, people are going to say this is a crazy scenario. Because everyone believes in Schwarzschild, but like, is this just me that's crazy, or is this not much nicer?
It looks like a bounce. It's a bounce.
I mean,
it's fine. But once you're through, if you believe in this inversion, and the physics is the same, it's just that 2 would send r to 1 over r squared, then you have an expanding shell.
Mm-hmm.
The inside will be what previously was outside, and the outside was previously was inside. Now, an expanding shell, if by some reason of continuity, they should have in some sense the same AGM mass, the one before crossing the horizon. There are cases in which the thing doesn't have enough momentum to go in, so it could stop and cross again. That what happens. So yeah, in this picture, you will be doing this. Going through, expanding a bit, stopping, and then going back, and I don't know, would come out of the horizon again. That sounds funny.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because we're using this particular picture with the A out good zero frame given by the rest of the universe. You have this foliation, which never crosses this region, and this is the trajectory of a shell, so you should take the exterior of this and glue it somewhere else. That's not, if you believe in the reflection symmetry, that somewhere else would be, for example, another crucible diamond like this, and then there's another foliation like this. Maybe you take only the outside of this one.
So,
and then you want to glue this exterior to this, maybe? But this can recollapse, or collapse, and then?
far it'd be simplified, because take first the case where the shell goes through the infinity once it bounces. You draw that kind of diagram?
Before you worry about recollapsing.
Yeah, and also, I mean, recollapsing would not come out, I mean, again, it's the same thing, right? Recollapsing, it could just recollapse here and form in this. It's not coming back.
Yeah.
It's just doing this.
We're also not that sure how much the story is dependent on the square symmetry, so.
But I think, you know, the point is that we have to.
Let me just make a So my understanding was that the changing sign of the lattice makes it so that essentially once the shell passes through the horizon, it's experiencing repulsive forces because of the time reverse nature of the interior region. Is that not correct?
The time reverse nature of the interior region. That's
right. It changes the initial velocity.
Yeah.
And the initial velocity is expanding.
Because you also have an inversion, and an inversion too makes what we're about to see. So, I don't know. You want me to draw a parallel?
I want you to draw a parallel. I think what you guys are trying to communicate would become very clear if you just draw a parallel diagram. What solution is you going to
do? It's here, and then you have that. Horizon here, and you have a shell which cups this, you know. And then I don't know.
Isn't it just this?
Okay.
Isn't it just this? And if it's infinity, then that means.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
So there's no problem.
No, that is just Amy Koski's theory. But.
So I don't know what it's about.
No,
so
because
the upper region is an inversion of the lower region with a kind of shrunk somehow.
Yeah, you have to tell me where the origin goes and where the infinity goes when you cross this.
This is where the shell winds up. It's here, R equals zero.
So, okay, this is R equals zero all over there.
This is not R equals
This
zero.
Is the shell.
This is the shell,
and
then it's
R equals
zero. R equals zero.
Yeah, R equals zero will be some curve here. That's what that means. And the horizon. So this is what you know, that you have something like that. And then the rest depends on how you move it here.
Yeah.
You can copy this same thing and time reverse it, and also inversion, but right? It's something like this. Okay, this is origin, this is origin. And how do you do that? At some point I was advocating this. You glue this two.
Yeah.
And you move this
line.
So this is this, and this is this. Okay, I draw my parallel diagram, but I don't believe in it. I don't know if I believe in it. This is where a shadow will go to infinity after crossing. So
where are you? So one thing, the outer boundary, if you really do what you said, the upper half of the drawing above the horizon looks differently than trying to.
Different
from what? If you really believe that the identification you just made, then can you draw the upper, can you actually draw the piece that you glued on to, so you've got another piece of the left and a lower piece of the right, can you really glue them together?
No, you can't make it planar. You can have two copies of this and put them on top of each other and glue them here, but it can't be drawn on that.
But it's because what he did with that thing is he did the inversion.
Yes.
And the inversion is not a conformal transformation. So, of the space time, right? So
you can draw an inversion, you just
you just draw something like this. Yes, it's not planar. It's like a ribbon with a twist in it.
Yes.
And then you draw the twist.
And then here you have to draw something like that.
Yes, good.
Yes, very good.
Good, okay, thank you.
You're back
now. You cannot twist it. Now you cannot twist the top one.
Yeah, you just twist the top one and it just goes
between
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
What?
I'm making 3D. Four, four, why is that? Three.
4D, this would happen. Here, so now you see the problem. This 90 degrees. Here, 45 degrees curves are not light. Light. That is just. Yes, that's.
But I guess that's why I just reflected that when you go to the space-time picture, you have something discontinuous happening.
Julian is advising us to begin the space time picture.
We shouldn't be drawing Ferrer's diagram. We should be sticking to your time in a conformal superspace. Look at curves there and see what happens to the dynamics of one shape degree of freedom with respect to another one. That's why I'm.
You're saying no.
Oh, I agree.
Oh, you agree?
I agree.
Okay. So, but like, can I pause just to say what's on the line here, right? Because if we're saying, these solutions are so different from GR, and like, the information paradox is different, the motivation for firewalls is different, the fate of an observer that falls into the horizon is different. So, I mean, as excited as I think this is, I'm nervous, right? I get nervous when I see this, right? That's why I think, because Lee, you said earlier, you said we should stop. I mean, we shouldn't think too much about Finchel anymore, but
I just wanted to draw something different. So, be less nervous. I would turn around and say this resolves the information paradox because there's a place where the information that made up the original star or the original shell goes. It's consistent with the global notion of unitarity in the shape dynamics framework. Because the time evolution is just continuous of the shell and the space and the spatial geometry is just continuous from the beginning to the end. There's no reason for a firewall. You don't know what happens to evaporating black holes because you haven't done that problem yet. But even if they don't evaporate, the singularity has been removed by a transversal to another exterior region. And that's all to the
point. I mean, at what point do we say this is for sure this is what's happening?
At the point when you can follow the evaporating black hole all the way through to the...
Can
you think of this as like your realization of black holes in the carrier or something?
It's
been suggested.
I personally think this is very primitive to start thinking about all of those things about black hole evaporation. Let me just make one comment. The thing that really strikes me about black holes is nearly all of the work I've read. I read a lovely book, I thought, very impressed by Suskind and Livesay on black hole thermodynamics. A slim volume, very nice to read. The entire discussion was one single black hole and asymptotically flat, and observers could be at infinity and so forth. Now, I'm very suspicious of this. If we assume that the universe is spatially closed, the overall condition is that the angular momentum is zero. The collapsed objects we know are in this universe in great quantities, they all have angular momentum. So for a start, they must all add up to zero. So there must be, I believe, massive correlations between these collapsed objects spread out through all the universe. And you cannot add, you can only add entropies of quantities of systems if they're statistically independent of each other. So I think the whole thing we may need to completely relook at.
He said, when if we trust that I said if you...
Sorry.
My sentence is perfect with if and when. he said, when can we trust the picture? I said, if and when you can have a straight story about evaporating black holes. I didn't need to imply that it was a trivial thing to go ahead and solve the problem of evaporating black holes. I do.
Oh, yes. No, I think there's a long, long way to go, and we may just have to start more or less from scratch.
But I think that the question that you're asking is, if you think about, for instance, the twin shell, which is more of a relational model,
yes.
Is can we have situations in which you have some relative notion of angular momentum? And I mean, even if the total thing sums to zero, you can still have some relative notion. So can you induce conditions on this shell or in this black hole or whatever that would mimic a Kerr black hole? And what we're saying, you know, we're kind of assuming.
Julian is not putting in doubt that you can have something like Kerr. He's saying that entropy
of an angular momentum
will be correlated. Therefore, the entropy of a single system, which is highly correlated with another one, is not sense.
I'm not talking about thermodynamics.
He was talking about that.
I think Lee wants to come.
Yeah, I just want to distinguish what you're saying from the following. Say that if you have a description of the full evolution of the closed universe in terms of a pure quantum state, as you envision doing, then there's no entropy in any case. Once you have entropy is only a description of an isolated, only makes sense in a pure isolated system.
One step at a time. So my first step is to understand Newtonian theory of the shape and how it's turned. The next one is to try and get to two genuine shape degrees of freedom in something that would resemble general relativity, but in shape dynamics form. And then begin to see where that leads us, and perhaps at the same time try and see even how quantum mechanics might come into these incredibly simple systems with only two shape degrees of freedom. And slowly work up. I see no way to really make progress except go step by step over it. Let me make one other remark. I've had many discussions with Carol Kuchas and read his papers carefully. And Carol visited me a few years ago. And I said, Carol, you would agree with me there are true degrees of freedom in general relativity, and they might well be the conformal degrees of freedom that Jimmy York and Neil and so forth identify. What is your position about all those other ones in the four-dimensional space-time metric? Do you regard them as being a residual sort of framework in which the true degrees of freedom evolve? And he said, yes, absolutely. And this was exactly the opinion that I got from him. But I think this is just completely confusing the issue. You should just think about a formal three geometry and forget all the rest and have a clear conceptual picture of what the three geometry is doing. And I think all of this thing is going to just, if we're going to really get somewhere with shape dynamics, we should think about how shapes evolve and just be very wary of all this stuff there that Carol was still taking with him. And he struggled with it for 30 years and he's given up on it.
But all this other stuff, I mean, it's you mean the kind of kinematics of space-time, the congruence of observers that are describing the space-time.
No. Actually, what we're mistaking, what happens is, there is the law which determines the unique curve in conformal superspace or in shape space. There's that law, and it's actually that law that leads us to think all that other stuff is there, because that's the distinguished representation. You can always best match and put into a distinguished representation and choose a distinguished time variable. But all of that, absolutely every single bit of it, is made possible by the law that enables you to get that unique curve in shape space. So you mustn't forget, you mustn't mistake what the law is doing for you for something that is ontological and is a physical thing. That's exactly what it is. You can, I mean, already in the three-body problem, you can build up Newtonian space and time just from what the two angles of the triangle are doing and the mass ratio. All the information is in that, and it's something that you add on to it. So you mustn't, you must distinguish carefully between these two.
Before I go to ask,
it's a good time. Okay, who are we clapping for?